I'm assuming we're live, okay? live. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Redacted. I'm Natalie Morris. That awkward pause brought to you by me. Just me, myself, and I. I'm alone tonight, but not really alone because I have you. Clayton's off for the night, and I also have David and Philip in the control room. Thanks so much for joining us. We have a lot of news to get to today. And it is the first day of November. It is the day after Halloween. Hopefully you're feeling good. And I want to thank Clayton for sitting in with me yesterday so I could follow around my kids in their costumes and that kind of thing. So let's get to the news. We have a story about the CIA maybe making a cover for Israel and why the October 7th attacks were able to happen at all. Was it really that no one was watching? That story just continues to smell, right? It stinks to high heaven. We also are going to bring on a guest to explain to us what are Palestinians thinking about all of this and break down some of these narratives about, is Hamas a representative of the Palestinian people? How do they feel about the hell that is raining down on them right now? Why won't they leave? These sort of simple questions that I think are lost in all of the screaming that we have. So we're going to talk to Ramzi Baroud about that, and I'm excited to hear his perspective. We are also going to talk about the World Health Organization's pandemic treaty because one group is doing something about it, pushing back so that the WHO does not take sovereign power away from nation states, as they have written down in black and white that they will do. This is not conspiracy at all, even though the media says, oh, no, that's not true. We fact checked it. I don't think they even read it, to be honest. And France has voted against gender neutral terms. Les Français will continue to be gendered with their pronouns of nouns, that is. We're going to talk about that and have a little fun talking about romance languages. That's my idea of fun. All that and more as Redacted starts right now. Easy Wind saying siding with one side keeps people dying. We are agreed. We try not to side with anyone on this show. We keep it neutral. We are only peace extremists. That's the only thing that we advocate for through and through. So thank you for joining the show where we try to break down these narratives, try not to respond with headlines. You probably notice headlines are written to make you have a visceral response. And then you're like, oh, yeah, well, I believe that. That must be true. So we read behind headlines. We present you with research that we find. And we present you with experts that bring us their perspective. And so I appreciate you coming with an open mind and with an attitude bent towards peace. We are non-pacifist peace extremist. That is my slogan. It shall be engraved on my gravestone. So thank you again for joining us. Hey, you know, we have a newsletter. You can find it at redacted.inc. It's totally free, just like the show you're watching. You just go there and you put in your email address and then click submit and you will get an email saying whether or not you want to join us, and please do. Then you get every single day the Redacted newsletter, which has a lot of the stories that we'll talk about in the show later that same day, plus a little bit more. Plus, you probably know that I really want people to read the original links to things so that they can create their own opinions, so that they can think for themselves. And so you may notice that the mainstream media tells you the news and doesn't link you out to any sources because they think you trust them. You shouldn't, and you shouldn't trust us either. So read the newsletter, tell us what you think, read the rest for yourself. We work really hard on it. It comes out every day that this show comes to you, Monday through Thursday. You can find it all at redacted.inc. Okay, so once again, you have only me tonight in the newsroom, but we also have David. You want to say hello, David? Show us where you're coming from. Hello. Wait, can't hear you. Cannot hear you.
Yeah, you got to unmute your microphone.
I am in Washington State coming from my living room. Hello.
Okay, very good. And Philip, who doesn't show us his face but always has gems of wisdom to share with us, is running the control.
I try.
Yes. Okay. They don't know. Sometimes they can be bombs. You can still share them. This is a safe place. Nobody gets canceled on Redacted. Unless you say something that maybe is lewd or offensive to somebody else personally, but no opinions. All opinions go here. Are you ready for this? Okay. Well, let's talk about the CIA, because why is the CIA sharing the blame for October 7th? And is this the U.S. covering for their buds Israel, or is there something else? So today, the Wall Street Journal reported that the CIA used to spy on Hamas, but they gave it up in the years after September 11th. Who buys this? I just wonder. When you see a headline like this, go ahead.
Were they still paying? Were we still financing them at that time when we stopped spying? Or were we spying to see how they were spending the money we were giving them? Like, how does that work?
Well, okay, let's see. The timeline, how does the timeline? Because Hamas was created in the late 80s. And they're saying here that they stopped in the years after 9/11. So that could be 2002. That could be last year, right? We've had many years since 9/11, if we're talking about 9/11, 2001. So I don't understand why they would say, yeah, we used to do that, but we just stopped for whatever reason. Now, first of all, if you've read Edward Snowden's work, you know that the CIA never detracts what it is they're working on. They never give up power. They never decide, we don't need to spy on that person anymore. That was fun. Especially if Hamas is what they tell us, and more of an extremist group that plans attacks, not just big ones like October 7th, but others as well on a regular basis. Because this is what Israel's been telling us, right? It's not just October 7th. It's the constant terrorizing of Hamas that's making us have this response. Well, again, I just buy this for 0 seconds. This is the CIA we're talking about. Spying on bad guys is kind of their reason for being. In fact, they justify spying on good guys just in case they dragnet bad guys. So in some point, like, the narrative has to play out one in two ways. Either they spied on them for a long time and they thought, these guys are cool. It's all okay. Nothing for us to see here, right? We're gonna stop that. Or they continue to spy and they're for some reason giving us a cover. I don't know. What do you think? An organization that Israel has been warning us about for decades, they thought, well, you do it. It's all good. You are our closest allies in the Middle East. We realize you think they're bad dudes. We trust you. It's all good. We won't do it ourselves. Now, this article tells us that the U.S. outsourced spying on Hamas to Israel, which we know that they have done with gusto. They thought that was okay because Hamas never made a direct threat to the U.S. Here's the Mark, I'm not going to try and say his last name, a retired CIA operations officer with extensive counterterrorism experience, says, in terms of intelligence failure, which really do lie mostly on Israel, I think we also share some of the blame for missing this event. Ceding the target to Israel, to the Israelis, now looks to have had consequences. So I'm just really struggling to believe this, but let's assume for a second that it's true. Could this then be a reason for the CIA said, well, we gotta spy more in the Middle East now. We dropped the ball on this one. Let the big boys in. We're the spy masters. Or should we prep ourselves for more spying from these collaborative governments? After this confession, now last week, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on X that he hadn't been warned about a planned attack by Hamas, but then he later deleted that tweet and apologized. And the apology came in the spirit of, I shouldn't have said that. I spoke out of turn. Now is the time for us to be responding. Go ahead.
Did he forget that he had been warned? And then he's like, he like tweeted that out. I've never been warned. Somebody's like, oh, wait, no. Yeah. Okay. They did tell me. I forgot that they did tell me that. Like, that's not exactly a forgettable moment, is it?
I don't think so. I mean, unless it's like you're warned every day and it's good night, Wesley. See you in the morning. I'll most likely kill you tomorrow. Right. Do you know what that's from? Movie reference?
Anyway? Yes, slightly butchered, but that was Princess Bride.
Yeah, it was.
Good night, Wesley.
Totally right.
Sleep well. I'll most likely kill you in the morning.
So maybe that's the life of Benjamin Netanyahu, that every day he has these threats from Hamas and that he just starts to forget and starts to not believe it. But then why would he tell us on X that, hey, you know, my intelligence didn't tell me anything about this. Didn't know a thing. That's it. So that is kind of unbelievable, given that Egyptian intelligence continues to say that they warned Israel of something big. That's specifically their quote. They warned of something big, and that Israel ignored it. So if Israel had the ball of spying and they didn't pick up on anything, and Egypt was warning, this narrative is falling apart, right? In fact, Reuters reported that Hamas even built a mock Israeli settlement, ran drills for October 7th, and posted videos online of them practicing as far back as September of 2022. So again, when Netanyahu apologized for that deleted tweet about not knowing anything, it was again in the spirit of, well, we got a war to fight now, we'll worry about that later. Which, for a thinking person, might say to you, let's put a beat, let's take a pause on this war while we figure out what's actually happening so that more innocent civilians don't die. That's not actually the marching orders at this point. It absolutely matters, because if intelligence knew of this massacre, it would mean they either were incompetent to stop it or they let it happen. And those people were used as bait for this war that they wanted with Palestinians. That's the cynical view. We don't know, right? Now, about that war, the world continues to watch as thousands of children die in horrific conditions. Thousands of children die in horrific conditions every day. The New York Times reports that the U.S. has tacitly accepted mass civilian casualties. That's a quote. That this will happen in Gaza from Israel's retaliations for the September 7th attacks. Now, the paper reports that the way they sort of put it is that the U.S. felt kind of bad about it. They don't like hearing it when they met with Israeli officials. But here is how they justified it. They said, or here's how they kind of swallowed that pill, is that it became evident to U.S. officials that Israeli leaders believed mass civilian casualties were an acceptable price in the military campaign. In private conversations with American counterparts, Israeli officials referred to how the United States and other allied powers resorted to devastating bombings in Germany and Japan during World War II, including dropping of the two atomic warheads in Hiroshima and Nagasaki to try to defeat those countries. And recall that those bombs didn't even function at full capacity. I think more than 30% of them failed. Or I think, actually, if I think back, I think only 30% worked. So the United States is familiar with accepting mass civilian casualties. So I guess, who are we to talk? Is what that says to me. We're humans watching other people's children die. That's who we are. And it feels awful. Collectively, it feels awful. At least 8,000 civilians have died. Palestinian civilians have died in these strikes, an estimated 40% of them children. Now, acclaimed journalist Seymour Hersh, who was doing the extensive reporting on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline bombing, he now is reporting this story as well. He says Israel has a goal of destroying at least 65% of the possible citywide escape routes for Hamas leadership, unless someone talks them out of it. So they give this complicated story of underground tunnels, and they're saying we need to destroy at least 65% of them. This is the goal. How will we know when that happens? I don't know. It's supposedly pretty stinking terrible down there, and they're just continuing to do that. And again, instead of talking them down, now the U.S. is sending 300 troops to specialize in communications and explosive ordnance disposal. Civilians have started evacuating through the border with Egypt, albeit slowly. We're starting to get that news just today that some have been let through to this passage down the Red Sea. But now Yemen has entered the war in missile and drone strikes on Israel, reportedly from Iran-backed rebels. Now, we know we had reports. Well, we don't know, right? We know there are reports that there were rebels from Yemen who escalated this. Now, Israel is saying they were Iranian-linked, that these were Western leaders who were funded by Iran. Well, okay, they have not offered proof of that. We have known since day one that the West wanted to link Iran to this and drag them in, and that they've been telling us for weeks and weeks, we're going to find a way to link Iran to this. We don't have it now, but we're pretty sure we will. and now we have these strikes. So we have to wait for confirmation. We're not sure. But, you know, as if this war isn't bad enough to think about it escalating with Iran is bone-chilling. Remember this from the 2020 campaign trail when President Biden worried that Trump was going to be the one to lead us to war with Iran?
The world has changed because what Trump has done. And the American people, including independents and some Republicans, know how bad he is, know how much he's misrepresented, know how he's getting close to getting us in a war. I said, as the walls close in on this man, I'm worried he's going to get us to war in Iran. Unfortunately, I may have been right. The fact of the matter is, there's a lot at stake in this election.
All right. Well, that didn't age very well, did it? Most of the wars we've had have been since the Biden administration took office. So let us know what you think. Yeah, go ahead, David, please.
Well, I was just going to say, and I wonder if because Iran is set to become part of BRICS on January 1st, 2024. So it's almost like there's a mad dash to try to get them before they're in BRICS, because then they're going to pull in Russia, China, and the other BRICS nations. So it's almost as if, you know, they're saying, hey, we got to hurry up and link Iran to this so that we can get them before they're in the BRICS.
That's a possibility. Although BRICS nations continue to insist that they are an economic group and not a defense military group, I guess we could test them if we really want to, because seems like leaders want to treat the planet as if it is a game of battleships.
Well, I don't think they have a choice because of NATO. I think NATO will force them to do more militarily with each other, because we are the bullies and we're out there just willy-nilly bombing all these places. And if the BRICS nations have to step up and stand up to us militarily, I don't think they have a choice.
Yeah, that could be interesting to see if BRICS becomes a defense organization more than an economic organization. And that would be really terrifying, because it would be countries with bigger armies than ours, countries that spend less and have more militaries than ours. So it's terrifying. There also were reports late in the day today that Saudi Arabia is going to allow the United States to launch attacks on behalf of Israel from their military bases outside of Saudi Arabia. That also is maybe surprising. I don't know if we'd use the word surprising. We weren't sure where Saudi Arabia would draw the line here. Originally, we thought maybe they would ally more with the Palestinians. We're just not sure. We just don't know. So right now, while this continues to be reported and unfold, it's best for us to not make assumptions, but also just question these major narratives. Again, like the CIA says, we did that for a while. We stopped spying. Guess we shouldn't have done that. I just call BS on that. And I don't know why they're doing that. Like, why get involved? Why make us think that you have ever given up a spy campaign? Why? I just can't. I don't know why. So if you can see some kind of narrative in there that I'm missing, let me know. Because again, this, we didn't see this coming. We should have, we probably could have, but there were no adults in the room. Like, the spy program was on autopilot. The pilots were taking a nap. You know, can't buy it.
That's like Monty Python levels of obliviousness. Yes. Like, to see them running the training exercises, building like actual like mock-ups of the attack, and they're just like, huh, look at those silly guys over there, you know. And it's, right? It's just like, I mean, it's like, it's almost comedic if it wasn't so tragic.
Yes. Yeah, awful. So it's hard to believe that Israeli intelligence didn't know about it. It's really hard to believe that the CIA didn't, and that they could have otherwise. And then when you put them both together, it just doesn't add up. And so again, that would add to either mass incompetence or using those people as bait for a war that they wanted anyway. So let me know if there's a third option that I just didn't see.
And I posted in our Telegram, I don't know if you guys saw it, in 2019, Netanyahu talking about specifically funding Hamas as a strategy to use them in Gaza. So, yeah. You know, I mean, as far as back that, they knew that this would be a strategy. So I feel like this is just one of those things that they knew was going to happen. They were funding them. They get in power. They cease elections. Don't allow any more elections from the point that they take power. And so it just feels like, because like we've talked about how they're the most sophisticated military in the world, the Israeli army, and how they just like even cats set off the border triggers and stuff. So it's like they were talking about how that part of the border was open. There were doors unlocked that they were walking into and getting into places that normally they wouldn't have been able to get access to. So it just all seems too convenient if you think about it, like,
right,
you know, with all the conveniences that were there when this happened.
Right. It's very upsetting to think about, you know, just either missing it or letting it happen. Both things are equally upsetting when you think of civilians who were harmed by this. So, hey, we want to remind you that if you subscribe to the show, you will get your name to pop up on the board behind me. You can't really see it much today because I'm alone and I have no co-anchor. Dog is my co-pilot. And by dog, I mean David. And
it also pops up on the bottom of the screen, though.
Yes.
So you can see that.
Right. So you'll see it on our lower thirds. So thank you for hitting like and subscribe. It's a free subscription to the show. Make sure you hit that notification bell. And please stick around. Stay, even though Clayton's not here, because I need to prove to him that I can do it without him just fine. Any of you who are married and, you know, switch tasks from time to time, you know what that means. So you'll have to stay. Stay with me, please. We have more news to get to. We're going to talk to Palestinian-American journalist Ramzi Baroud, and I want him to just sort of explain the way that Palestinians are feeling and looking at this conflict, how they look at innocent civilian deaths on the Israeli side as well as on Palestinian side, how they look at these anti-Semitic demonstrations around the world and how they're looking at support from them. I really am excited to get his take on this. So that's coming up after the break. But first, we want to tell you about our friends over at BioOptimizers because, hey, there's a Black Friday mega sale happening now and will last the entire time of the month of November. And listen carefully, because this mega deal is available only for our redacted listeners with our code. So right now we have those ever-growing Black Friday wish lists, but this year I challenge you to make health a top priority. Instead of those impulse purchases, focus on what really matters, like sleep. Get addicted to wonderful, healing, restorative sleep. We all know the importance of sleep for our overall well-being. And while some might say you can't buy a good night's sleep, well, you can if you've got the right supplements. That's why we talk about Magnesium Breakthrough all the time from BioOptimizers. It's truly a game changer. As you know, because we rave about this all the time, it's the only product that I actually use at night lately, especially because my mind's been racing. Holidays are coming, things like that. So if I find myself unable to sleep, I don't feel bad at all reaching for some of these because I know it won't make me feel like I just took a big dose of a sleeping pill or something like that. So keep that in mind. Again, BioOptimizers Black Friday mega sale is happening right now, lasting the entire month of November. The biggest discount you can get and amazing gifts with purchases are available only at biooptimizers.com/redacted and use our code redacted. Again, this is your opportunity to reap all of these amazing benefits. So one more time, biooptimizers.com/redacted and enter code redacted at checkout. Well, we can study the Palestinian response to the crisis in Gaza, or we can ask someone to explain it. I really feel like the media is assuming a lot of knowledge about this conflict that maybe should not be assumed. So that's why I've invited Ramzi Baroud back to the program. He's a Palestinian American. He's been on our show before, but not since the October 7th attacks on Tel Aviv and the Israeli government's response to basically destroy all of Gaza. So thank you for joining me. I would like you to sort of break this down like I'm 5 years old. Why did Hamas launch the October 7th attacks? Can we start there?
Absolutely. There is the starting point here, Natalie, would have to be from how the media in the U.S. decided to perceive what is happening in Palestine and Israel. And one term that pretty much everybody has used, from the American officials, mainstream media, even mainstream celebrity, is the term unprovoked. This is an unprovoked attack. Now, if I am a person just who is not aware in the least of what is happening in Palestine and Israel, and someone tells me unprovoked, I will develop a position saying, well, since it's unprovoked, Israel had every right to do what it's doing, but maybe they are being a bit much about it. But that's a question I would really like to deal with, the term unprovoked. And how do you do that? Let's unpack two different issues here. Who are the people of Gaza? And who are the fighters that we Palestinians call the resistance who carried out the October 7 attacks? Let's look at the population of Gaza. Over 70%, in some estimates they say even more, are either refugees or descendants of refugees who come from historic Palestine. Historic Palestine is today's Israel. Now, the people of Gaza, about 2.3 million of them, they live under the most impoverished conditions because, not because they are uneducated and they can't find jobs. To the contrary, the education level in Palestine is one of the highest in the Middle East, despite of the Israeli occupation, despite the system of apartheid. But they are poor because they are under a hermetic Israeli siege that has extended from 2006 or 2007 until today, uninterrupted. So you have refugees living under siege. They have no political rights whatsoever. None of their political aspirations have been met. And even their right to protest peacefully at the fence separating this besieged enclave from Israel, they are met with sniper fires. Hundreds of Palestinians, children, really mostly minors, about 80 to 90% of all of those killed at the fence protesting are under the age of 18 or 17. They can't even do that. So that takes us to the second question. Who are the people who carried out the fight? Now, the media, and including, frankly, some sympathetic media, just simply because they are not aware of the deeper meanings of all of this, they are perceiving this to be a Hamas-Israel war. Hamas was established in 1987. Prior to that, for about 40 years, 39 to 40 years, Israel had existed. It existed on the ruins of historic Palestine. It existed as an occupying power. And those who did the fighting during those 14 years were not the Islamists. The Islamists were not even part of any of this discussion. They were secular groups that are part of the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. And many of them were socialists. In fact, it was the communists of Gaza that fought against the Israeli occupation in the 60s and in the 70s and up to the 80s. In the late 80s, the Islamic movements began emerging in Gaza. And it's these Islamic movements that eventually represent the current core of the resistance. But that doesn't mean that all Palestinians are Islamists or all Palestinians voted for Hamas, or if this is actually about Hamas per se, because if Hamas didn't exist, the resistance would have continued either way. The people who carried out the attack on October 7 are people who were either born during the siege or were children. They were children, they were toddlers when the siege was imposed. We are looking at about 17 years here. Many of them were in their late teens, early 20s. So they were children when the siege started. And it also meant that they have never stepped a foot outside Gaza. So you are talking about an isolated generation, an alienated generation, a marginalized generation that had very little access to food, no access to hospitals, no access to universities, no access to their families in the West Bank, being trained with the idea that the only way you can break this siege, and it's hard to argue against that logic, to be entirely frank, and I'll tell you why, the only way to break the siege is to fight your way out. And the reason that it's hard,
right,
to
but I'd like to sort of push back against that just a little bit, because I understand the need to break out of this cage, but the idea when it brings in innocent civilians, how is that brought into the plan?
If you asked me this question on October 7th or 8th, I would have given, just to make this easy, kind of a blank condemnation. And I still do condemn any And it's not really my responsibility. I'm not a political leader or spokesman for any of these groups, but we Palestinians understand that since our civilians are in constant danger, as we see the genocide happening in Gaza, we should not be in a position in which we justify in any way the intentional targeting of civilians. But because the Israeli narrative began breaking down from the decapitated babies that was repeated by Biden, by CNN, by all the mainstream channels in the United States, and then the rape, and the, you know, all of these things, and all of them were proven either untrue or were not substantiated in any way, it becomes difficult to actually go and make that condemnation, knowing that this is going to be used against Palestinians and we actually don't know.
Okay, that I understand because, yes, please.
Yes, absolutely. Let's have an investigation. We see what Israel is doing in Gaza. Let's get the United Nations involved, the Human Rights Council of the UN, to investigate what happened in Israel on October 7th. And anyone who has carried out any intentional attack on civilians has to be held accountable. But Israel and Israeli war criminals in Gaza also have to be held accountable. So this is what we've been asking for all these years, is international investigation that does not involve American pressure or Washington's intervention.
Okay, I completely understand that. I do think that we need to wait to see what's true and what's not. And this is a vociferous war of propaganda right now. And I don't put any stock into politicians saying they condemn this or they condemn that. As long as civilians are dying and there is no call for a ceasefire to figure it all out. But one of the things that I think those of us who are outside might wonder is, wouldn't Hamas have known that no matter the extent of the attack, whether, you know, it was as brutal as they say or not, that it would cause Israel to rain down hell on Gaza? And is there a movement or a thought that, like, oh my God, what have they done? What have they brought to our doorstep?
Okay, so let me tell you what is my own perception and what is being said, because this is a very kind of active conversation happening.
Okay,
not within Palestine itself, but even in the Middle East as well. We know that if you capture a single Israeli soldier, Israel is going to rain hell on Gaza and kill hundreds. So imagine if you capture nearly 150 soldiers, plus settlers, plus civilians, and so forth and so on. So what is going to happen then? If we just look a little bit earlier between what happened in September when Benjamin Netanyahu stood in front of the General Assembly with a map of the Middle East, with the words "the new Middle East" on it, and between what happened on October 7th, maybe we can begin to understand why this attack was launched the way it was. It seemed that it sorted out that Palestine is no longer a cause for the Arabs, for the Muslims, for the Middle East, for the world. Every attempt at pressuring Israel to concede to a single UN resolution has failed. Palestinians are being gunned down at a large number in the West Bank. The UN says 2022 was the highest number of Palestinians killed since 2005. That's in the West Bank alone. In 2023, they broke that record by June. So Israel is becoming yet more and more violent. Plans to take over, annex the West Bank. It's a done deal. It's over for Palestinians. Now, when the Palestinians look at their allies in the Middle East, say the Saudis are now normalizing. There is a new Middle East, and Netanyahu stands in front of the United Nations General Assembly, and he announces, this is the new Middle East. The Saudis are with us, the Bahrainis, the Emiratis, the Moroccans, the Sudanese. It's over for you Palestinians. And all of this happening with Palestine not being part of the conversation. Now, as someone who traveled and lived in many Muslim countries as a journalist, throughout the years, I tell you, many countries, especially Indonesia, Malaysia, and others, these large countries of large Muslim population, they look at Saudi Arabia for their foreign policy. I'm not saying that they don't have independent foreign policy. I'm saying that they are, in a way, try to find the balance because of the spiritual power that the Saudis have, because of the Mecca and because of Islamic holy sites and so forth, it would only be natural for the Saudis to normalize and other large Muslim majority countries to normalize. If Palestinians lose that last line of defense, it is over. The Palestinian cause is going to turn into something else entirely. So the debate within the Palestinian community now is, should have we done this knowing we are going to recenter Palestine as the top of the agenda of the entire region, and carry on with our resistance as usual, or not take that risk and maybe save some lives for now, but having Palestine completely lost as a cause that matters in the Middle East. And that becomes a strategic question. And I know the outcome is painful. And if I were in that position, would I have made it as a political analyst? I don't know. But this is at least the rationale that is prevailing in Palestine and in Gaza in particular.
Right. And so is that, you think, what the narrative is that is motivating people to go to pro-Palestinian rallies? Is that like, hey, Palestine, they had to break free, that's why we're here? Because I think the media is showing that that is automatic anti-Semitism, and I think that that bears looking into, because of course you can want Palestine to be free and also not be anti-Semitic at the same time, but it is inspiring anti-Semitism. So can you respond to that?
Yes, absolutely. Now, again, this argument maybe would have had a little bit of kind of potential to become a conversation. This is no longer there. I mean, I heard Scott Ritter, I believe, a few days ago saying, if Israel has lost me, and it did, I think it's going to lose everybody. Because there's always been this kind of group of people. You have your hardcore pro-Palestine people. These are the people coming from different ideological schools of thoughts, different humanitarian schools of thoughts, and people who are just, who read a lot, and they are familiar with the Palestinian discourse. And then you have your hardcore Israeli supporters. But you also have this group in the middle that maybe is kind of nominally pro-Israel just because CNN and others say Israel is a good idea, right? Well, that group is now shifting to the Palestinian side. They tell you, even if we don't understand what is the politics of it all, there can never be a justification of carrying out a genocide against innocent people. And so we are flooded. I mean, like the number of influencers that are reaching out to us, wanting our point of view, speaking out for Palestine. These are people who do, you know, kind of makeup products, and then suddenly they are part of a political conversation. I have been doing this for 3 decades. It's completely unprecedented to me, this kind of attention and support that Palestine. Now we need to create a clear separation between this whole anti-Semitism claim, which in some cases is true. Yes. There are people there who hate the Jews for being Jews, and that's not going to change anything, you know. But then you have this.
Yes, and I just want to validate that it's very scary right now to be Jewish, and it's very scary to be Middle Eastern. It's scary to be both groups right now, and that both fears are valid. And so
absolutely, but just watching the Jewish activists, the pro-Palestine Jewish activists, particularly with the Jewish Voice for Peace,
yes,
taking over the House of Representatives, taking over the New York train stations, this is really, in my opinion, this is the most functional use of our activism. When Jewish student groups, when Jewish civil society groups, when Jewish activists and rabbis go to the street and say, no, we have to make a clear separation. We stand with the Palestinians because once we said never again, and it should be never again to everybody. But this is not, Netanyahu does not represent the Jewish people, and Israel is not the capital of the Jewish religion. And we need to create this very clear separation. Otherwise, indeed, this could be mistaken for something entirely different.
Now, this is a really obvious question, but I still feel like I want to ask it because you see this devastation, and I know that the borders have not been opened for evacuation of Gaza, and Israel keeps saying, well, we warned them. We tell each building when we're going to bomb them. But why do we not see more exodus? Is there really just this appetite to hold on to this one piece of land?
You know, there's a lot. The question is being answered by many, as in Egypt is saying no. Egypt has rejected Antony Blinken's offer to, but I have a different take on it. And as a historian, you just look, you need to look for historical precedents. Did this happen before? Did Palestinians leave Gaza at one point? And indeed they have. A few years ago, the situation was so dire. Israel was cutting off fuel supplies, electricity. The situation was horrific. There was no food. So at one point, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians began gathering at the crossing between Egypt and Gaza. And they actually crossed the border. They overpowered the Egyptian army. And they crossed in their hundreds of thousands. Some estimates say about 500,000 crossed the border. But here's the thing. Every single one of them, save 250 students who needed to go to Russia or Ukraine or other countries, every single one of them came back. They bought food, they bought supplies, they bought fuel, they bought whatever life-saving things that they needed, and then they came back to Gaza. And this is my theory. I really don't think it's about the Egyptian army. Yes, there are those who are going to stand up and maybe even shoot at Palestinians trying to cross the border, but in the Egyptian army in general is quite sympathetic to the Palestinians. And I don't think they are going to allow for another massacre, and they would have allowed Palestinians to cross. Palestinians are not crossing into Egypt because they don't want to cross into Egypt. So they are being chased after by bomb. They are going from the north to the south. Beit Lahia, Nusayrat, Khan Yunis, Rafah, and so forth and so on. They are just running in circles. But nobody seems to be following this arrow that is taking them to Egypt and not bringing them back.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody's fooled in the fact that they want them to be evacuated and stay there. I believe that even the Israeli former defense minister said, well, we'll make them camps. And then that is their life. Right. So I don't know who would wish that on a refugee life on anybody. But I really do appreciate your analysis of this. I've been watching your show on YouTube for this context, and I was really happy that you decided to come to talk to us today. So where can we find your YouTube channel?
Actually, it would be better to follow me on TikTok, which is at Ramzi Baroud Official. I am available on YouTube, but there's, you know, shadow banning and all of that. But my TikTok channel is more active and has more freedom to speak out. So.
Okay, very good. Thank you again for your time. I can't say how much I appreciate it.
Thank you, Natalie.
All right. Well, I want to thank Ramzi for his time, and I want to thank you for watching that segment. I see in the chat that some of you found that really uncomfortable because there is an appetite for just a complete condemnation of Hamas and the October 7th attacks. And even if that is where you stand on this, don't you want to know what the sentiment is at these pro-Palestine events, at these pro-Palestine speeches, or what do people feel about this? I definitely did feel like I needed a better understanding of this. So again, even if you felt uncomfortable with that, I hope you appreciated the perspective, because I find him somebody who's not reactionary, who has been speaking in this way for a long time. And you don't have to take a side to understand both sides. So like our comment at the top of the show from somebody, Easy Wind, I think. I wrote it down. Yeah, Easy Wind. Siding with one side makes people keep dying. So that is absolutely not our goal here. So thank you for joining us and agreeing to get uncomfortable together. We have more news to get to. That World Health Organization pandemic treaty we've been warning you about is marching along. It is supposed to go into effect next May unless our governments say, we actually do not want to live in the united world of the WHO. We don't think they deserve global powers. Well, one organization now is pushing back, at least in the United States, telling the president and Congress, please get us out of the World Health Organization and the United Nations. While we're at it, let's do that. Let's not cede power and sovereignty to those jokers. So we have a guest who's going to tell us how we can push back against this, because at least we've got some leadership on this now. We also are going to talk about language in France and how the French Senate has decided no to gender-neutral words in France. They're going to keep the gendered pronouns to keep people who learn languages, romance languages, on their toes for the rest of their lives, presumably. But first, we want to tell you about our friends over at HelloFresh, because HelloFresh is a farm-fresh, pre-portioned ingredient delivery service that brings seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. So skip the trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. Now, you know Halloween is past. Thanksgiving is barreling down on us. The holidays are here. Do you want to be meal planning as well as planning for your holiday meals and your holiday trips and your holiday shopping? You do not. Meal planning is drudgery, for me especially. So that's where HelloFresh's 15-minute meals come in. These quick fixes help you get a wholesome meal on the table in less time than it takes to get delivery. Of course, we all want to cut back on errands and spending time in checkout lines, so skip the extra grocery store trip and get fresh ingredients and delicious recipes delivered with HelloFresh. Now, so if you would like to try them, you can, for our listeners only, use the code REDACTEDFREE for a free breakfast for life. That's one breakfast item per box while your subscription is active. So you go there, you're going to be ordering your dinners, but they come with a different breakfast. Now, this doesn't mean you save the leftovers for breakfast, which I'm going to be honest with you, I have no problem with doing. I like eating leftovers for breakfast. No shame in that. But we're talking about a different breakfast, okay? Free breakfast for life at HelloFresh.com. So you have to go to HelloFresh.com/redactedfree. You see it right there on your screen. And use the code REDACTEDFREE at checkout. So one more time. HelloFresh.com/redactedfree. Use the code REDACTEDFREE. That is HelloFresh. They are America's number one meal kit. The World Health Organization pandemic treaty is marching right along, set to be put into law next May if nothing happens by global governments. This is the treaty we've been warning you about that would supersede global governments' ability to self-govern whenever the WHO decides that there is not even an emergency, but a potential for emergency. It's probably the biggest power grab we've ever seen in modern times. It is binding. It will cost your country a lot of money. Some politicians are kind of speaking out. Some politicians are speaking out against it, but not very many. One organization is doing something. That's the Global Health Project. They launched a national campaign that urges President Biden and Congress to oppose this treaty. Joining us to discuss is Dr. Kat Lindley, the director of the Global Health Project. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me today.
Now, can you tell me who is the Global Health Project and why are you doing this?
We are a coalition of different organizations, scientists, physicians, educators, advocates who came together last summer to start talking about what has happened and how do we make sure that this doesn't happen again. So we actually produced a video with physicians and speaking about their own journey to what happened during the pandemic, how they came to realize that the system was broken and things like that. For myself, I've always been, since I'm from Croatia, I was born in Croatia, and I live in the United States. I went to medical school here. So I always looked at this whole pandemic issue globally because I was always intrigued by the fact that every government was saying build back better. The messaging came together. And then, we started following WHO recommendations and things like that. And as that was happening, WHO started putting together this pandemic treaty and the amendments to the IHR. And obviously that became a grave concern.
Okay. So can you outline for me the dangers that you see in this pandemic treaty and, as you say, a grave concern?
So it's exactly like you said. What happened during the pandemic, WHO did come up with some recommendations. The country's regulatory agencies followed them as they chose to do so. But with the pandemic treaty and amendments to the IHR, as you said, this will not be recommendations anymore. They're going to be obligations, and we're going to have to comply to them. The amendments to the IHR is international health regulation that we've adopted into our international law. Some of those amendments, particularly Article 12, who give Director General powers to cause, to actually call something, you know, health emergency of international concerns, whether if it's criteria or not. And if that happens, then the Director General or his regional directors would actually have powers to dictate how any country would comply, whether that's with quarantine, travel restrictions, medication, treatments, potential new vaccines, and things like that. From our standpoint, if you look at this, that means that this international body that has nothing to do with our own country would actually have sovereignty over our health policies. And as far as I'm concerned, that actually would have implications on national sovereignty as well.
So one of the things that bothers me the most about it is not just the fact that they would dictate what vaccines must be taken, what lockdowns must be had, what surveillance must be done, you know, what mask mandates may or may not be put in place, what vaccines must be taken, but also this sort of existential threat of climate that may then cause future pandemics means that they can redistribute resources. So if they say, well, the meat industry is really hurting the planet and we could get more zoonotic viral diseases, then nobody can eat meat anymore because we say this. I mean, I don't think that's too much of a stretch. The redistribution of resources around possible emergencies is the thing that keeps me up at night. Do you want to speak to that at all?
No, I agree. And that goes under the One Health agenda within the treaty itself. What people are not aware, most of our countries have actually already started implementing this One Health. And there is, you know, departments within HHS that actually deal with that. In One Health, what they say is that the life of humans, animals, plants are equal to each other. And again, yes, they can be influenced by climate change and other things. So all of these things can interact, and we will have to worry about, you know, they were trying to indicate over the summer that climate change is our new pandemic, and United Nations actually speaks about that a lot. And you're exactly right. They can decide not only the foods and things like that, but also water. There's been recently a lot of talks coming from WEF and United Nations that we have to be concerned about the water and other natural resources.
Yes, that's also terrifying. Now, the media and covering this pandemic treaty, if they do it all, which they don't very often, you know, they publish headlines like, oh, it's not binding. Oh, it's not really going to take away government sovereignty. Those are myth busted, they say, without really proving it. They're just saying that that's what they think, as if they haven't read it. We have read it. And we've shown them these bits on the show where the word binding is crossed out, or these, you know, human rights are crossed out. So why do you think the media wants to sell this as harmless?
One of my favorite things is when the media says it's not a treaty. And the reason they say that is because WHO has realized that people around the world have started several petitions. They don't want it. So they changed the name from treaty to agreement to CA++, and recently accord or accord agreement. I forget which one comes first. I think the reason media is doing this is because that's what they've done for the past 2-3 years. I don't want to be cynical, but I would just say,
well, you
say
can be that, a little cynical that, and if we admit to being cynical, then at least then at least we can extrapolate a little bit. It's okay.
Well, I'm not sure who their master is anymore. I would say the masters are definitely, you know, these private-public partnerships that we see with WHO. We definitely see that they have lost the integrity. You know, I know you're a journalist and this is your passion and your love, but I do remember in the 90s, I loved watching journalists just tell the story, put the facts out there and allow the viewer to actually come up with a conclusion. We don't have any of that anymore. And I think that's one of the, you know, everyone says physicians have lost their trust, and we have. We have done a poor job this far pandemic. But I would say same thing for journalists. They've lost all of our trust because they're making conclusions for us. And then if you dare to disagree, they call you a name, they put a label, misinformation, disinformation, and all that. So I would say their master is definitely not the people, and that's why they're trying to sell it to us.
Yeah. One of the things that I have wondered is that if they admit that this is a scary prospect and that it may put into place mandatory mask mandates or mandatory vaccines or mandatory lockdowns, then they would have to admit that those things caused harm during the pandemic. And the media has not been wanting to do that. Even they just can't eat that slice of humble pie, I suppose. That's my cynical take on it. What do you think?
It's hard to admit when you did something wrong, but it's human to admit that you did something wrong. So I hope that some of them find their humanity back.
Right. Now, and speaking of doing something wrong, the WHO had terrible performance during the pandemic. They provided no science, no guidelines. They played politics. They rolled out a vaccine that they did not admit the truth about. So why do you think governments would defer to this organization that, in my opinion, didn't even meet D-level work, if we're talking about it on academic terms? What is the rationale of that?
You know, I think it goes back to these public-private partnerships. I don't know if you recently read some of the stories that we've written in Brownstone Epoch Times, but FDA actually has a, I forget what they call it, but it's like an understanding, memorandum of understanding with Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Why would our FDA have a memorandum of understanding with Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation? And then you take Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who are probably one of the biggest funders of WHO. And you see all of these connections that they have within the governments, within these organizations. And there's a lot of collaboration. I think there is obviously a lot of potential earnings and things like that they're all looking forward to. And you know, as people resign from government, they become heads of Pfizer or don't go on their boards and things like that. There's so much intermingling in these organization and our governments that no one is really looking too deep into. One of the interesting things, actually, WHO did really good in India, in the Uttar Pradesh region, where they allowed the ivermectin to be used for the COVID-19, but everyone kind of forgot about that and followed them on all the other flawed recommendations they had. As far as I'm concerned, the most important thing for everyone to realize is WHO should not be in charge of our health. If there is another pandemic that comes again, you would want to have a physician who actually has a relationship with you and you can decide if you can be treated or not. You don't want someone who says, well, you're not allowed to use this medication. You only can use this other medication like we've seen during this pandemic.
Now, I regularly find false information on Google Bard. That's Google's AI program. So when I looked into who's funding the Global Health Project, your initiative, Google Bard tells me that you have donations from Bill and Melinda Gates and also the World Health Organization. It could not prove where it had found those. When I asked, can you link me to where that information is, it said it cannot. So can you respond to that? Because why would you be working against the WHO and asking Congress to not give them this power if the GHP was accepting donations from them and also Bill and Melinda Gates?
So after we finish this, I'm going to do the same search to see exactly what they're saying, because
I'll send you a screenshot. Yeah.
That's awesome. No, obviously, we are completely funded by people. We have asked for donations on our website. You can donate as well. We have not received any big fundings like that. And we had a recent project for Maui concert where we raised, I think we raised about $30,000+, and that was directly from donations from the people. So that couldn't be further from the truth.
Okay. I figured as much.
You know, we could do so much more if that was true, but it's definitely not true.
Okay. All right. So what you're doing with this initiative is trying to tell people this is something scary. Get involved, educate yourself about it, and tell your representatives, yes. Right? So what else can they do?
The most important thing is to actually call the representative office and say, are you aware that there is a pandemic treaty that the World Health Assembly is going to meet in May of next year, and they're going to vote on pandemic treaty, but also are you aware on the amendments to the international health regulation? Because most of those are being pushed by our own health and human services. You actually need to look at these two documents together because they empower each other. Ultimately, what we need to do is withdraw from WHO. There is no reason for WHO to be receiving funding from the United States and for us to collaborate with them and then have them tell us how we can plan for future pandemics if they come, or emergencies or whatever they are. None of that should have power. WHO should not have power over that. Only patient physicians should be in charge of their own health. It's very important that everyone reaches out to their congresswomen, congressmen, and the senators.
There was a bill in Congress to prevent the president from signing this. I can't remember the sponsor off the top of my head, but it hasn't gone very far as I can tell. Is that correct?
There are several bills in the House. One of them is by Chip Roy. Andy Biggs, I believe, had one as well. And then Senator Johnson had one in Senate. They haven't gone far, but there is a renewed interest because I think Americans are becoming more concerned where is their money going to, especially with the trillions of dollars that we owe. So, and, you know, having a new speaker in the House who is fiscally responsible, I think there's going to be a little bit more traction. So it's really important to reach out to them.
Okay, great. So where can we find out more about your initiative? I do suggest everyone watch the 9-minute video that is summarizing this. It's at Global Health Project. So the on X, it's at Global H Project. And then anywhere else we should look?
Yes. So you can, like you say, you can find us on Twitter, and our website is globalhealthproject.org. But more importantly, these documents are available online. It's very important to follow different organizations who are speaking out about this. SovereigntyCoalition.org is another organization who is speaking about this and has several align acts that you can sign that will go directly to your representatives and ask them to look into this. Ultimately, what we need to ask is to exit WHO, most likely United Nations as well, but that's for another day.
Okay, I'm with you on both. I would love for nothing better than for our government to not be a part of those organizations. So thank you so much for speaking out about this and this initiative, and we will follow. And everyone who has an elected representative in whatever, especially Western countries, I think are the ones who are most gung-ho about this. But Eastern countries too, reach out and tell your government no on this. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you.
All right. Well, incidentally, when this project launched just earlier this week, the Global Health Project launched a 9-minute video about all of the things we've been talking about are inside this pandemic treaty, such as right to survey, right to instate lockdowns, right to instate mask mandates, the right to force medicines and vaccines on populations. All of that stuff is in that 9-minute video. It's had millions of views just since it's launched in a few days. So people are listening to this. Also, a little like humble brag is that one of the screens that we put together here on Redacted talking about these many powers and my explanation of that made it into that 9-minute video, which made me feel good because it means I'm studying appropriately. So they said, look, our video's, you know, gone viral. It's doing really well. And then I was watching it and I was like, ooh, that's my voice. That's our screen. So that means that we are following the right trail here together, guys. We are sniffing along exactly where we should be sniffing. That sounded weird. We're sniffing where we should be sniffing.
No, I thought that sounded great.
No, it's only weird if we're sniffing where we shouldn't be sniffing. That's
right.
When it gets
exactly.
Weird.
Exactly. Yeah.
If you're supposed to be there, it's okay. You have permission. If you're not, you're making it awkward.
We're not really supposed to be. I mean, we're looking at things they don't want us to look at. So, but
that's true.
By our definitions, we should be sniffing there. So, okay, let's keep our nose clean. Like that pun. but what I'm saying here is that this is something that we are all collectively interested in. We have to do something. You can't do nothing here. You can't do nothing and then complain later that the WHO is making you lock down, wear a mask in your own house, and then coming around and shooting you with vaccines. And oh, also you can't eat meat because they've decided that's an environmental threat that will cause pandemics. So you have no food supply. That sounds like the worst that could happen, right? But some measure of that has already happened to all of us. And so we need to pay attention. So thank you for watching this segment. Share it, join, follow them on X, share that video. All right, well, we have more news to get to. We're going to talk about why France has once again rejected gender-neutral language. I would like to remind you that you can like and subscribe to this show. Please do, to prove that I'm doing okay here without hubby around. Remember, I too am a professional. Both of us were trained journalists. We worked for the mainstream media. Clayton worked for Fox News, and I was with CBS and NBC, so I know what I'm doing. You're in good hands. I appreciate you being here with me. So please hit that like button so that we can find other like-minded individuals and we can all be open-minded together. All right. Well, have you ever studied a romance language? And if you have, you know that there are gendered nouns. And this is what makes learning romance languages so maddening. Well, France is going to keep it that way. They voted not to change their language to gender-neutral terms. They said that this would have completely changed the way that French is spoken. Some say it would have even destroyed the language. So what I mean by this pronouns is not what your personal pronoun, he, she, they, them. I'm talking about nouns. So for instance, I speak Spanish, Portuguese, and some Italian. I don't speak French, but so Portuguese is the language I speak the best. So we're saying right here, mesa is feminine. It's a mesa, or in Spanish, la, right? These glasses I'm wearing, óculos, it would be ush, óculos, because it's a masculine noun. So each thing is masculine. Usually it kind of makes sense, although not with the word vagina. Yeah, I said it. In French, for whatever reason, the pronoun is masculine. It's le vagine. I don't know why. That makes no sense. It doesn't exist for you. So I'm not sure about that. But most, I'm going to call that an irregular verb. That's probably what you're, or a regular noun, because it doesn't seem like that fits. Don't argue with me like that, about that, unless you have one. Now, gender ideologists, they don't like the idea of gendered things. I guess it's like, I mean, I don't know exactly. I don't know what the rationale is between like finding it offensive that my glasses are masculine or the table is feminine. Maybe it's like, you know, gender is fluid. So if the eyeglasses are masculine, then you can't change it. And it hurts my feelings because I want gender to be fluid. I'm not quite in line with this. And, you know, another problem that ideologists had, and this does seem a little bit unfair. I'm going to give that, you know. There's a point here is that in a romance language, if there's a group of things and only one of them is masculine, then the whole group is referred to as masculine. So you can have like eight sisters and when talking and you're a boy and when talking about that group, you still would use the male pronouns like ellos, like them, right? Yes, I get it. It's not fair. But the proposal was for them to make it instead of elle, il. It's basically like the English translation of they, them, instead of gendering a group. Well, in advance of this vote on Monday, which the French Senate has voted down, saying none of these changes. In fact, they voted for a ban on it. That's kind of a double negative. They voted for the ban, meaning they're against the changes. You see what I mean. French President Emmanuel Macron said there's no need to be threatened by this because the masculine is neutral. Can you accept that? The masculine is neutral? Or do you still think that's patriarchal? I don't know. What do you think? Can the masculine be neutral? I'm fine with that. But I don't.
If we all agree, then yes.
Yeah.
Is that the whole point of language is to convey meaning?
Yes. Yeah. I don't find a lot of emotion in gendered pronouns and groups and things like that. But I do get it. You know, I have, because I speak Portuguese, I have often referred to a group of things that are like a group of people that are mostly women and realize like, oh, I can't use a feminine grouping because there's a man there. So I don't know. It gives you pause, but it's just the way it's done. Here are some of the other proposed changes. Like we just talked about this eel. I'm sorry, my French accent's terrible. Instead of il and elle, like he or she, it's a combined. Celu is like those. And instead there's, you know, of like the feminine or masculine version of that. Also this dot E suffix at the end of words. So for example, president dot E dot S to refer to people who held that profession that could be both female and male. So for instance, like, you could be journalista, right? Or journalistu or something like that. But instead, no, we'll just combine that. So informatica, right? Informatico. But instead, you have the same for both genders. I don't know. I guess it might make it a little easier to learn. But then there's new punctuation to think about. So spell check would have to learn it too. Now, again, they voted against this. This proposal was brought up 2 years ago, and politicians said then that it would destroy the French language. And so some people who feel like it's their life's destiny to change this French language just brought it up again, and again, they lost. So probably this is not the last we've heard of this. So let me know what you think. Would this make it easier, harder? Do we really need to reorder society because of gender ideology? And if so, where do we stop, right? Especially continuing to see, we see, you know, different groups of people who think they're animals or what have you. Well, then do we have to reorder language for that too? Or shall we just use what we've got because the world is already so stinking confusing? And let's get to that later in a more peaceful time in humanity. Maybe. Maybe that's where we should go. Speaking of language, I thought I'd end with this. This video is going viral this week. This is a biological man who is complaining to the manager at many restaurants about hardworking restaurant employees for basically trusting their instincts and calling him sir. And he seems so shocked that his woman costume is not working and he continues to become sir that he needs to tell them exactly how it hurts his feelings. This is a bit of a long montage, but like I said, it's going viral this week, and it's sort of a good palate cleanser, if you will, from all the war talk we've had. Let us know what you think of this person.
It looks like he's having a nice feast.
She, her. Yeah. It's okay. It's all good.
But it was not all good.
Hi. I use she, her pronouns. I'm not sir.
Oh, sir.
Yeah, like it's like a knife in the heart. I did specifically ask ahead of time not to be called sir. Yeah, I'm just gonna go.
Okay.
Yeah, the sweet water starts at, okay.
I'm so sorry, I apologize.
It's just always like a knife. It always hurts every single time. I was wondering if there's a manager I could talk to about something that happened. Yeah, I was called sir.
Oh, okay.
It just really sucks every time it happens.
Sorry about that.
I don't need to be called ma'am. I just need to not be called sir, you know?
Thank you. Did you call me sir? I just want to tell you that the person who gave me this called me sir.
What?
Called me sir.
Oh.
It's just like, it kind of just hurts a lot to get called sir.
Oh, sorry about that. Okay.
Very good. Right. Thank you so much. No. Oh, I'm, yeah. Thank you. I'm not a sir. Nothing like a good misgendering. It is a knife in the gut when I get called sir. I feel like I need to tell him. I need to tell him that hurt. It hurts more though, and it's not intentional because it means like this is sir to him. I know you didn't mean it, but I'm not a sir.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I know you didn't mean it. It's just, you know, it hurts. I know when people clock me, it's fine, but like it does kind of hurt. Thank you. I'm not sir.
Oh, sorry.
Not sir. The guy who dropped the food off, he called me sir twice in a row.
all the criminal, him know that, and GMs.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I wish I could be the manager at one of those restaurants.
I mean, look, this is a great way to get people to spit in your food, guy. Like, is this worth it? You know, because now that this has gone viral, people are going to see you coming. If that were my friend, I would want them to be more resilient and not get their feelings hurt by strangers who are just acting on instinct. That's what I would hope if that were my friend. Not to wage wars everywhere and think that you're educating people because of your really good woman costume and crop tops. It just speaks to the idea that, like, his need to say it is more important than their need to hear it. It's egocentric.
As far as I'm concerned, it's basically affirming mental illness. Like, I feel like that is mental illness, and it's like you're affirming that, and the more you affirm it, the more it's going to happen.
Yeah, playing the victim here, you know, and
yeah.
Let us know what you think of that bit of language as well, plus the idea of changing the French language, any romance language, any gendered pronouns, including vagina. Let me know. Yeah, actually, that one I'd be on board. We don't need to make any other like pronoun switches in the French language, but how about we give the vagina back to the ladies? How about that? Let's make that solidly.
Call it vagino.
No. No, there's no, I reject to all of the above. No male vagina, no neo vagina. That one I really hate. The idea of neo vagina is a surgically constructed Vaginex. Vagina that is, you know, put on a biological male.
The Latinx one is one that always cracks me up because it's like in trying to like get rid of the gendered language of the romance languages, they make it something that so people that speak Spanish can't really pronounce.
Right.
There's no way to do NX Equis. In Spanish.
Yeah.
Latinx.
No, it'd be Latin. Latin.
Yeah. Or
like
Latin.
It's like just a weird. Yeah.
Yeah. It is. That is a strange one too. Definitely. The neo vagina, actually, that hurts my feelings. Like if someone's got a neo vagina that was constructed by a surgeon, what is mine? A paleo? Like, no, I don't like that at all.
Archaeo vagina?
Right.
Archaeo vagina.
Yeah. It is artifact vagina, old kind. All right, we're going to end it on the vagina talk, everybody. Thank you so much for joining our show. Before it gets any weirder, we're going to stop right now. Let us know what you think of all of the above. We will be back here tomorrow on Thursday. Don't forget that if you're in North America, your clocks change this weekend. So we'll be back tomorrow and also next week. And it will be a different time for you in North America. If you're in Europe, it's already changed. This is a confusing time of year. So make sure you subscribe, hit that little bell notification so you know when we're going live so you don't miss anything because of all the time changes and the craziness. So again, thank you so much for being here. We will be back tomorrow night. See you tomorrow, everybody.